Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 14th Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll open today's show with Bill Resnick talking to Alice Slater, chair of the board of directors of World Beyond War. They discuss Russia's attack on Ukraine, why it happened, how it might be resolved, and the role of a neutral Ukraine. Old Mole Jan Hocken talks today with Cager Claybaugh, former president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, ILWU, that's Local 4. They talk about the successful fight in Vancouver against what would have been the largest oil-by-rail terminal in North America. Cager Claybaugh is featured in the Necessity film and will be joining other activists featured in the film at the Kiggins screening on March 20th. Kiggins Theater is in Vancouver, Washington. Cager talks with Jan today about the history of the fight against Asura Savage and the importance of labor and environmental alliances in responding to the climate crisis. We'll conclude today's program with Luisa Martinez interviewing activist and scholar Jana Silverman. They discuss recent political developments in Brazil. Jana Silverman holds a PhD in labor and development economics from the State University of Campinas and is currently a postdoctoral scholar at the Center for Global Workers' Rights at Penn State University. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. And thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. Before we get to today's Old Mole show, I want to remind listeners that it's KBOO's All Thrills No Frills special programming drive through March 19th. Listeners, family, friends, and neighbors will have the opportunity to support KBOO Radio, an important part of our community and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment. KBOO is a nonprofit organization with 80% of our funding coming from our members. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, writers, and KBOO has trained thousands of people to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. While we aren't in the station to take your calls, you can show your support by giving online at kboo.fm/give. You can text KBOO to 44-321. Or you can support the Postal Service and Community Radio by mailing your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Support KBOO, support Community Radio today. Now, back to the Old Mole Variety Hour with Bill Resnick and Alice Slater.
Alice Slater, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill. Great to be here.
Alice Slater is a board member of the organization World Beyond War and also the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. She also represents the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation at the United Nations. She began her long quest for peace on Earth when, as a suburban homemaker raising children, she organized Eugene McCarthy's presidential challenge in her community to Johnson's illegal war in Vietnam. She also serves on the People's Climate Committee in New York City, working for 100% green energy by 2030. Today we'll be discussing Russia's attack on Ukraine, understanding as a product of, for one, NATO's policy led by the U.S. to expand NATO and place missiles in Ukraine on Russia's western border, and second, Russia's fear, of course, of being encircled and attacked. We also discuss how the war might be resolved and stopped, which would require defeating U.S. elites committed to the maintenance of U.S. political, economic, and space supremacy. In addition, we focus on Ukraine's success against a very superior Russian army, partly through unconventional guerrilla tactics, and also nonviolent resistance and popular disobedience. The young Chinese guy who stood in front of the tank, forced it to go around him, that inspired many acts of nonviolent resistance in Ukraine. So Alice Slater, the establishment press began reporting, even before the invasion, discussing how George Kennan, who developed the containment strategy for Russia after World War II, as well as several former hardline secretaries of state, including Henry Kissinger or George Shultz, they all said it would be a great mistake for NATO to expand into Ukraine, that the nuclear-armed Russians would never permit it. But for the last 10 days or so, the establishment press has been calling it Putin's war. How do you understand the long history of this Ukraine war? And to whom or what do you assign responsibility?
Well, I think we have to remember what General Eisenhower, who became president, told us in his farewell address. He warned America about the military-industrial complex and its undue influence on public affairs. And we are seeing this now on steroids. As a matter of fact, Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA director that was briefing Bush and Clinton every morning, he was a top CIA guy, he quit in disgust and formed VIPs, Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And he said, it's not the military-industrial complex anymore. I said, what is it, Ray? He said, it's the Mickey Mat. The military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academic, think tank complex. They're all in bed with each other, and they're making huge sums of money on war. There have been articles about how Boeing, Lockheed, and Raytheon are so thrilled about all the arms sales they're making with the Ukraine war. It's been in the papers. They're unashamed to even say how pleased they are. And Biden's Secretary of War, you know, we call it defense, is from the board of Raytheon. So I think we have to really start looking at it and how they control the media, because it's awful to even read the press today. They keep telling you how insane and horrible Putin is. And of course, it's terrible what Putin is doing there. But they keep saying how he provoked the war in Ukraine without any of the history. And you just quoted some of the top government advisors from the establishment who said NATO expansion would be a mistake. Gorbachev and Reagan, when the wall fell, Gorbachev let all of Eastern Europe go without a shot. It was like a miracle. He dissolved the Warsaw Pact. And he and Reagan met in Reykjavik. And he said to Reagan, let's get rid of all our nuclear weapons. Reagan said, great idea, but Gorbachev said, don't do Star Wars. And Reagan says, I can't give up Star Wars. And that was like, we had our documents to dominate and control the military use of space. And actually, Trump actually set up the Space Department separate from the Air Force. I mean, that's their mission, to dominate and control the military use of space. So, of course, Russia and China are not going to give up their nukes if we're going to dominate space. That's part of it. But the other thing, Gorbachev was so concerned about a united Germany when the wall fell, being part of NATO, because I didn't know this, but Russia lost 27 million people to the Nazi onslaught. I mean, that's a number we never know about. The U.S. lost 3,000 people in the World Trade Center for the first time, and we went bananas. We started a whole global war on terror from that. So anyway, Reagan said to Gorbachev, don't worry, I give you my word, let Germany be reunited, let them come into our NATO alliance, and we will not expand NATO. And now they have taken so many countries into NATO right up to Russia's border. I think it's like another 14 countries, all of Eastern Europe into NATO. Plus, we had a treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty with the Soviet Union, that we said we weren't going to put anti-ballistic missiles in only two bases, one in Moscow and one in North Dakota, and we weren't going to build them any other place. This was in 72 with the Soviet Union, and that allowed us to stop the missile race because we weren't doing anti-missiles. So Bush walked out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty and put missiles in Romania, and then Trump put them in Poland. So we're creeping up closer and closer, and Putin made this incredible speech about 2 weeks before the war started saying, this is my red line, you cannot invite Ukraine into NATO. And we said, you can't tell us what to do. I mean, this is crazy. There was another thing that we did that we shouldn't have done when Clinton bombed Kosovo. We had a treaty with the UN that we would never bomb another country without the Security Council approval unless we were under imminent threat of attack. Well, Russia vetoed the UN going to war in Kosovo because they were supporting the other side, Serbia. And Clinton said, the hell with you, and just got together a NATO troop. Like, we don't even obey any laws. We just have our own rules-based order, which is whoever has the power makes the rules. You know, we have all this international law that we're disregarding. So this is what Putin had his red line. Don't invite Ukraine into NATO. And we said, you can't tell us what to do. And then we got this nutjob president in Ukraine that wants arms. He wants us to fly. He wants us to attack. And we're humoring him. And I've never seen such media coverage of a war. I mean, did you see these kinds of pictures night and day in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, now in Yemen? We're killing people every day in Yemen. You're seeing this on the news? You're seeing mothers crying and holding babies? No, only in Ukraine. I don't understand that, except we're finding out everybody's welcoming all these Ukrainian immigrants, thank God, they're getting out of the way of the war. But if they're black or brown, they're not welcome. I mean, there's something really awful about this. We helped overthrow a legally elected government in Ukraine in 2014. This Victoria Nuland in our State Department, who Biden has there as his number four woman, said, well, Yats is the guys. They were figuring out. They were sending in money and troops, and they were going to help overthrow this legally elected president because he decided to go with Russia's economic market instead of the EU. They were giving him a better deal, and we overthrew him. And the guy that came in said, from now on, we're only going to speak Ukrainian. And the whole eastern third of Ukraine is settled by Russians. I mean, it was part of Russia forever. So those people rose up, and Russia came in to help them, and they had a referendum, and something like 80% or more voted to go with Russia. So they left, and then there were these disputed areas, the Donbas and Lushenko. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but anyway, Ukraine killed 14,000 people in there since 2014, and there were Minsk agreements. They were supposed to negotiate and make it a federation or whatever. Anyway, the smart thing that the whole world should be calling for is for Ukraine to be neutral, like Austria was and Finland. That's how they avoided being destroyed during the war. And if that's what Putin was asking for, that they be neutral, they not be aligned with our military alliance against Russia. It's inexplicable to me that you can't even get this in the news today. And I mean, I talk to people about this, and they think, you know, you've got to hate Putin. That's it. Hate Putin. Hate Putin. I mean, come on. Why didn't they hate Bush or Obama or that was bombing the crap out of other countries? I mean, we were killing babies and destroying hospitals, and we were doing it for years in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And we keep telling how Putin's censoring the press in Russia, but do you know, like in America now, we can't read Russia Today, which is like the BBC. It's their Russian. You know, I'd like to hear what Russia's saying. We're not allowed. We've been cut off, too, in America, you know, the land of the free and the home of the brave and First Amendment and free speech.
This is KB Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The variety is in the struggles from below that we cover. I'm talking to Alice Slater of World Beyond War, active in many other struggles. We just discussed how the U.S. State Department and people like even Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and George Kennan, all of them recognized that it was a terrible mistake to take over all of Eastern Europe and the Ukraine. This is not a brief or a case for the Russians and the Russian system, but there's huge fear in Russia over armed Germany and the rest of the NATO allies repeating what happened in World War II, which is a vast killing of Russians. So, Alice, you named the forces most committed to U.S. supremacy, with the U.S. as the deciders, not just on the planet, but also in space. The U.S. is now pushing the Chinese and the Russians to challenge them in space.
This is so unnecessary. China and Russia have tabled a draft treaty in 2008 and again in 2014 to ban weapons in space. and the U.S. blocks it, and the Commission on Disarmament, you need consensus to discuss the treaty and amend it and, you know, make it better, we won't even let anybody talk about it. And every year there's a resolution in the United Nations Disarmament Committee, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space, and the U.S. votes against it, and China and Russia support it and put it in. I mean, you can't imagine how bad we are. And the other thing that we're doing, when the U.S. and Israel boasted about having hacked Iran's uranium enrichment plant with the Stuxnet virus. There was a lot of news, hey, we got this new Stuxnet virus. Putin called Obama, this was a story in the New York Times, I'm surprised they reported it, and said, hey, why don't we negotiate a cyber war ban treaty? And Obama said no. And that's another resolution they've been putting into UN recently, China and Russia, to negotiate a treaty to stop cyber war. We're shooting ourselves in the foot if we don't negotiate for peace in space and cyber war, you know. And it's money that's driving it. It's big money. That's what's driving it.
I agree, of course. There's the national security establishment. There's the CIA. There's the military-industrial complex. Also, the corporations and the big banks, especially the finance world, they are kept in power over the economy of the entire planet because they run the banking system. And it's only because U.S. power is so great and the U.S. is supreme that the U.S. can continue to run that whole banking system, which extracts tremendous amounts of money from the other countries of the world. Not the Europeans, of course, but the entire global South paying for it.
I mean, China's coming up. We have a new competitor, and they're going to gang up with Russia. They gave a terrific speech, a joint statement at the Olympics, China and Russia. I'm telling everybody to read it. They're begging for the treaties for peace and space, cyber war, robotics, and they're talking about a new, more peaceful world, and we're not. We are drunk on power. We're like the Wild West. At one point, Russia was asking to join NATO when we kept expanding it, and we said no. You know, we needed an enemy. Gorbachev said, let us come into NATO, and we said no, because they didn't want to be on the outside. They had changed their whole system. And boy, did we fix that. We practically elected Yeltsin, who was this drunken darling of the patriarchs and the corporate plutocrats, and they raped Russia economically so that their life expectancy went down to something like 56 compared to being in the 70s. Then Putin came in and put them on, you know, on the up and up, straightened them out. He's popular there, you know. What he's doing now is terrible, but he got them into a better condition. You know, after World War II, we came in with a Marshall Plan for Italy and for Germany and for Japan, and we fixed them all up. And we didn't do anything for Russia when the war fell. We pillaged their corporations and their resources, their minerals, and we sent in our plutocrats, and we supported the worst kind of plutocracy developing there, and it was like ugly. So we're reaping the whirlwind, and I don't think we're going to win economically. I mean, first of all, the United States has 800 military bases in 80 countries around the world. This is what we did after World War II, instead of bringing the troops home. I mean, Russia has like 3 and China has 1 or 2. I mean, with nothing, you know, compared to us. Russia's right around its country. It's not in Asia or, you know, where we are, all over the world.
Alice, the Ukraine deserves to be a country. Russia, for all the historical reasons, it's necessary that Ukraine remain neutral. They don't want the Russian bear to become more belligerent.
Right.
Yeah, Ukraine, they have done extremely well at checking the much more powerful, at least powerful weapons, Russian army. In fact, and a larger army through guerrilla tactics, unconventional warfare like in Afghanistan. Your website has had the story of Ukrainian resistance, not their armed resistance, the unconventional warfare, about popular nonviolent resistance. That story deserves to be told.
But, you know, we have it in America, too. It doesn't get told, you know. But the Ukrainian nonviolent people should be talking like this colleague of mine, Yuri Shelyazhenko. He's the head of the Ukrainian Pacifist Society, and he's a professor at a university in Kiev, and he's on the board of World Beyond War. And he talks about that Ukraine should be neutral. They shouldn't join NATO, you know. They should have nonviolent resistance. There's a lot of people trying to push through, and anything we can do to amplify their message, definitely good. I'd look at worldbeyondwar.org, Ukraine, and look for Yuri Shelyazhenko. The uprising in Ukraine against Russia should be also uprising against this nutjob who's their president, who wants more arms, more American planes, which just means more people are going to be killed. I mean, they're not going to defeat Russia, so they should make a deal. There's nothing wrong with acquiescing to Putin's original red line before he invaded, that they promised not to join NATO and they stay neutral. And then in the Donbass and Luzhanko, those two places that were mixed, that didn't resign, there's a Minsk agreement that Ukraine has been ignoring. And the U.S. keeps selling arms to Ukraine. We should not be selling arms to Ukraine so they can shoot at Russians. We should stop all the bullets. I mean, if Ukraine didn't have arms, they'd have to take the deal, right? And the war would be over and everybody would be fine. It would be neutral. They wouldn't be in NATO. What's the loss? That they're not in NATO? NATO should be disbanded. NATO was a Cold War alliance that should have been disbanded when Gorbachev disbanded the Warsaw Pact. It was kept going because it sells bullets and armaments and missiles and drones and all these terrible things. That's the only industry we have that's good in America. Everything else we got to import.
I know you're a very active climate action person. For one reason, so much wealth of the world is going into armaments and so little is going into creating a clean and green economy based on electricity. I think that the climate action movements are ready to, in fact, take on the military-industrial complex. I hope so. That seems to me the best chance in the United States to begin really transforming this country into one that uses its wealth to make sure the planet is still inhabitable.
It's a no-brainer. It's just that you can't get it said in the media because it's owned by the military people and the oil people that are making money and don't want it to happen. Look at what they're talking about now, how much money gas is. What they should be talking about now is cutting the military budget in half and giving everybody an electric car so we don't have to raise the gas price. They're trying to figure out how they're going to drill for more oil right now. I mean, this is like lunacy when we know that we got 30 years before the climate goes down the tubes, you know. I mean, we should make alliances with all the climate protectors and say, let's go where the money is. And I mean, we should just call for a moratorium on all military spending for the next 10 years, and every dollar should go into windmills and solar panels and geothermal and efficiency. Like we did when we geared up for World War II. We stopped making cars and materials, and we only made tanks and guns. Well, right now, that's all we should be making is windmills and solar panels and clean grids or whatever they need. We have all the solutions. We know what to do. There's no secret. We can fix it. We just have the wrong intentions right now.
And we can end the kind of wars that we've been experiencing all over the world. Alice Slater, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Right. So long.
Great flood of tears that we've cried for our brothers and sisters.
That was Buffy St. Marie with Sing Our Own Song. And before that, you heard Bill Resnick talking with Alice Slater about Russia's attack on Ukraine, why it happened and how it might be resolved, and the need to stop fighting wars. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. Later in our program, Luisa Martinez interviews activist and scholar Jana Silverman, and they'll discuss recent political developments in Brazil. We'll also hear from Jan Hocken and Cager Claybaugh, former president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union. They will be talking about the history of the fight against Tesouro Savage and the importance of labor and environmental alliances in responding to the climate crisis. Before we hear from Jan Hocken and Cager Claybaugh, I want to remind folks that it's KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills special programming drive. Information on that special programming can be found on the KBOO website homepage, kboo.fm. It is also Women's History Month, and you won't want to miss those offerings. The Old Mole Variety Hour has been part of KBOO's long history, heard weekly on the Monday Morning Radio Zine public affairs programming since the fall of 1989. The Old Mole focuses on politics and culture from a democratic, socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective, a perspective emphasizing egalitarian relations and democracy, and has carried us forward for over 33 years. So before we get back to this week's program, I want to encourage listeners to support KBOO Radio and programs like The Old Mole. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. While we aren't in the station to take your calls, you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44-321. Or you can support the Postal Service and Community Radio by mailing your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Support KBOO, support Community Radio today. And now, Jan Hocken and Cager Claybaugh.
Cager Claybaugh, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you're former president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 4 in Vancouver. And because of your work and commitment to progressive politics, we invited you to be part of the film set here in our region, Necessity, Rails, Rivers, and the Thin Green Line. And it's wonderful to not only have you as part of the film, but also to have you joining us for the theatrical premiere in Vancouver this Sunday. That'll be at 2:00, and you'll be there with some of the other featured participants in the film to respond to audience questions in the Q&A. So let's start with what led you to accept our invitation to be part of this film that tells a bigger story beyond Vancouver, but include your work there at the port on the fight against expansion of oil by rail in our region.
Well, the reason that I say we decided to be part of it, because it was Longshore Local 4 that actually gave me permission to be part of it and represent us during the film. The reason we decided to be part of it, is we were proud of the work that we did in battling the Tesouro oil export facility. You know, we rely on the river for our livelihood, as many people do. A while back during another interview, I said that I think 2 out of every 5 jobs in Washington is related to trade. And I underestimated that. I gave the wrong numbers. I believe it's actually closer to 4 out of every 5 jobs in Washington is related to trade.
Can you say a little bit about what that encompasses when you say related to trade?
So you're a farmer or an agricultural worker. You know, the wheat's getting exported, or your hay is getting exported, or your fruit's getting exported. You know, your job's related to trade. If you're trucking steel comes in on ship, leaves by truck. You know, the truck drivers, you know, the dispatchers in those jobs, you know, the mechanics in those jobs, their jobs are related to trade. I mean, once you start breaking it down, you know, and it's not just shipping, of course. You know, Boeing workers, you know, their jobs are related to trade as well. You know, that's how heavily we rely on trade in the state of Washington. But in Vancouver, you know, our jobs wholeheartedly depend on trade, and that river is the lifeblood of our job. And when Tesouro came in, said that they were going to build the largest oil export terminal in the United States. We took a second to look at what that could mean to us. We knew that we would get jobs there. We knew that it would benefit us, but it wouldn't be a lot of jobs. What we looked at is how they were shipping their oil to other facilities. And when we started looking into it, that's when all the accidents were happening. I mean, it seemed like they couldn't go a week without one of their trains derailing and exploding into a fireball, right? And then Loch Meganic happened and, you know, destroyed that town. I can't remember how many people it killed, but Quebec. And so anyway, at that point, our union meeting talked about it, whether or not we wanted to support that project. And we voted on it as a unanimous yes to oppose the project and to not support that terminal being built. And the reason is, you know, if towns get blown up in Quebec, does it affect us? No, it's horrible, but does it affect us? No. If a leak happens in the middle of a wheat field in the middle of North Dakota, does that affect us? No. Does it suck? Yeah. If a train derails and blows up in Montana, does that affect us? No. Does it suck? Yeah. But if a train blows up in downtown Vancouver, if a train derails and spills into the river, if a ship were to lose steering and end up on the jetty at the mouth of the river, would that affect us? Yes. It would shut us down for a long time. There wouldn't be any ship traffic coming up or down the river. So at that point, we decided best thing we can do is oppose this. As a longshore worker, we don't get to decide what cargoes we handle, what cargoes we don't. Contractually, we're bound to handle whatever cargo we're hired to handle. But this was an instance where we could actually be proactive, and we knew that we didn't want to handle crude oil. And we knew that the only way we could keep from having to handle crude oil was to get involved and keep the terminal from being built. And we went to our port commission right after Tesoro had announced that they were going to try to build the terminal there. And we went on record as opposing the Tesoro facility. And I'll never forget, Columbia River Keepers were there, and they were there to do the same thing. And luckily, we got to speak ahead of them. We were actually able to go on record and oppose the terminal before the Sierra Club came out and opposed it.
Now, you're partly emphasizing perhaps here how labor and environmental groups historically have been pitted against each other in this obscene forced choice, either, you know, pick what you want, jobs, yeah, in the short term or a livable planet or environment. How do you respond to that horrible forced choice that these companies kind of pit environmentalists against workers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They make it sound like you have to be either one way or the other, right? You know, you can't be a patriot. You can't be a union worker and oppose fossil fuel companies, right? I mean, if you oppose fossil fuel, then, you know, you're a tree hugger.
Even that language kind of feminizes the environmental movement and,
right,
and appealing to a kind of macho masculinity among workers by casting it in those gendered terms.
Yeah, I guess I've never really thought of it that way, but yeah, that's exactly, you know, what they try to make you feel ashamed for caring about the environment, right? And you know, I'm not gonna. I kind of like it when people give me a hard time saying, "Oh, are you a tree hugger?" I'm like, "Damn right, right. I love the forest, right? There's nothing I like better than driving through the redwoods. You know, I just bought 20 acres up in Goldendale, 16 of them wooded." For people to, you know, try to make it sound like environmentalists are horrible, it's like, hey, you know, most of these people that give you a hard time are also sportsmen, right? Hey, you like fish to catch? Maybe you should care about the environment. You like hunting deer? Maybe you should care about the environment. You like going camping in the woods? Well, maybe you should care about the environment before global warming gets so bad that, you know, there's only so many years we can have the worst fires on record before we don't have any forests left. You know, it's like, really kind of think about what you're saying and who are you protecting? Okay, I get it. You know, you see these guys driving their trucks around, driving their fast cars. I get it. Yeah. I don't know if they're afraid there's never going to be gasoline and they won't be able to drive their 68 Camaros or, you know, whatever they're driving. But, you know, that's not the issue here. The issue is, why are we exporting coal and oil to other countries so that, you know, companies can use them for energy or production where they don't have environmental standards?
Yeah, so like, a lot of this is oil coming through the region for export.
Right, right. People have a misunderstanding, first of all, what a longshoreman does. When we say we're longshoremen, they're like longshore workers. When we say we're longshore workers, they're like, oh, gosh, how do you stay out on ships for that long? Like, I've never been out on the ocean in a ship. I've been out in a fishing boat a couple times, but you know, we don't go out on the boats. We load and unload the ships. You know, that's what a longshore worker does, is we unload and load ocean going vessels.
And the ILWU has a long history of militant organizing and fighting for the rights of workers. Can you say a little bit about that as it takes you into this period we're in around the climate crisis, and how the traditions of ILWU may be important as we continue this fight, not only in the sacrifice zones of Native communities, but we're all in a sense now in sacrifice zones. You said about the lifeblood of the river,
right?
And rivers elsewhere in the air. How do you see the traditions of ILWU as perhaps helping us confront the crisis?
Well, you know, when you're talking about the traditions of the ILWU, you know, Forbes calls us the most dangerous union in the world, and we wear that with a badge of honor, right? It's like, damn right we are. And, you know, the reason we are is because the rank and file makes the decisions, right? We don't hire our representatives off the street. All of our representatives are business agents, our labor relations, our presidents, our executive board members, you know, all these reps have to come from the longshore industry, you know, whether that's local or whether that's the longshore division or the international, it doesn't matter. You have to come from the union to lead the union.
And there's a tradition of democracy in the union.
Right. And that leader has to do what the rank and file says. And Harry Bridges always said, if the rank and file makes the decision, then the decision is always the right one. So when you're talking about what we've done in the past, you know, I mean, I can look back as far as the 40s when our union took a stand and refused, you know, right before World War II or during World War II, we refused to load scrap ships that were bound for Japan. Why would we do that? Why would we load scrap ships to send to Japan to be built into planes and ships to fight us? And our guys took that stand. There's been other stands like that. You know, it's always about doing what's right as far as we're concerned, you know, whether that's for the community, you know, the nation or the worker, it doesn't matter. We're going to do what we agree is right. It's not one person making the decision. It's the entire membership making the decision.
So in the film, you tell some of the story of initially the kind of mixed reactions among workers to the Kai activists who were on the river in the port to stop the ships carrying tar sands pipes up to that lethal project of the tar sands oil fields in Canada. But you were saying that it was a different issue resisting the building of that Tesoro Savage terminal there. And you talk some in the film about the different reactions to the Kai activists and also to the terminal coming in, which, as always, promised jobs and reducing taxes. You kind of expose that sham appeal. But in closing, have there been any struggles within the local four about how to respond to the fight against fossil fuels in this region? Or is that an ongoing kind of conversation?
When the Kai activists, you know, did their blockade to keep the ship carrying the Trans Mountain pipe from docking, you know, some of our guys were like, yeah, great, that's awesome. And other guys were just like, you know, hey, get out of the way, you know, that's our job, we need to do it, right? The membership is never going to, you know, agree 100%.
Why was how did you get to such agreement on opposition to the terminal? Was there a lot that you had to organize around that, or was that a no-brainer?
It was a no-brainer as far as we were concerned. They were going to take property that we work, and they were going to replace it with a rail loading and unloading yard. They were going to replace that property with oil tanks, right? They were going to take possible berth space for ships for theirs. We have a windmill ship come in, you know, and we're unloading windmill blades. You know, it takes about 35 to 50 guys per shift to unload a windmill ship, right? And they take a lot of space out in the yard. You know,
they're big.
They're 200 and some feet long. You know, you got to have big machines to load them onto. You got to have big machines to unload them and set them down out in the yard. You know, and later on when they decide to come and pick those up, it takes big machines to load them onto a truck. It takes a lot of guys. Talking about jobs per acre, a windmill job is a lot of jobs per acre. When you're talking about jobs per acre with an oil export facility, you're not. It takes what? Three guys to unload a train? Takes maybe one guy to load a ship? I mean, you hook up a hose and press start, right? I mean, I don't know. I've never worked with one, but I know that it's not a lot of jobs. And they take a lot of acreage. And there's just, you know, there's no benefit to us, really. It only served to hurt us by supporting that job. You know, you have the danger of the river getting shut down if there was some kind of spill. If they look to expand sooner or later, we're running out of places where we can work. We have to have laydown space to put the cargo when we unload it from the ship. We have to have space to load the trucks. We have to have space to load the trains. Big export companies that come in and they handle, you know, liquid bulk. And we already see it right in the middle of our port. The companies that handle liquid bulk, they take a lot of space and they're hard to work around. And there's just no jobs created there. Now you've got Tesoro pretty much right in the middle of our port. You know, they've got a lot of tanks there. And yeah, they employ a number of people, but it doesn't seem like they ever employ more or less.
You're saying Tesoro is there, but they did not get the expansion they sought?
Tesoro and Newstar have a loading and unloading facility right in the middle of the port. They also have tanks out on Fruit Valley, out near the rail yard. There's a pipeline that runs from the port out to Fruit Valley. And they, you know, it runs underneath the neighborhoods there in Fruit Valley, probably pretty close to the school and everything.
Cager Claybaugh, it's so good to have you on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. And I thank you again and for the ILWU Local 4 for supporting this documentary film that the community will be able to see at the Kiggins Theater. They can go on the Kiggins Theater website to get tickets, and that you'll be joining us for a Q&A after the screening, which we really look forward to. It'll be a time of both celebrating the successes of this movement to save the planet, but also to continue to do the work we need to and find ways where communities can come together around this fight against the expansion of fossil fuels. Thanks so much, Cager, for taking your time to be with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for including us. And it's very important, the work that's being done. And, you know, we want to support it. And we also, you know, because we did beat the Tesoro export facility, you know, we also want to thank everybody that helped us. We couldn't have done it alone. We were just a small spoke in that wheel. And we were just glad we could do our part. And we really appreciate everyone else that came together to help us, to help the community, help the environment, really.
Thank you.
We will no longer hear your commands. We will slide your control from our lands. Redirect the flame of our anger and pain. And pity the shame for what you do in God's name.
That was more of Buffy St. Marie, Sing Our Own Song. Before that, you heard Jan Hawken talking with Cager Claybaugh, former president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, ILWU, Local 4, about the successful fight in Vancouver against what would have been the largest oil-by-rail terminal in North America. And Cager Claybaugh is featured in the Necessity film and will be joining other activists featured in the film at the Kiggins Theater in Vancouver. The documentary Necessity, Climate Justice and the Thin Green Line will have its theatrical premiere at the Kiggins Theater in downtown Vancouver, Washington. This is the second film in a two-part series on climate activism, directed by Jan Hocken, filmmaker and Old Mole, along with co-director Samantha Prowse. That is, again, March 20th on Sunday, this coming Sunday, Necessity, Climate Justice, and the Thin Green Line. It will premiere at the Kiggins Theater in downtown Vancouver, 2 p.m. Tickets are available on the Kiggins Theater website, kigginstheater.com. Next, on the Old Mole, we conclude today's program with Luisa Martinez and more international politics as she talks with activist and scholar Jana Silverman as they discuss recent political developments in Brazil.
Hey there, Olmos. This is Luisa, and I have the pleasure of interviewing activist and scholar Jana Silverman. Jana holds a PhD in labor and development economics from the State University of Campinas in Brazil, and is currently a postdoctoral scholar at the Center for Global Workers' Rights at Penn State. She's been active in the Fora Bolsonaro protests against Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, and she's also an executive committee member of the U.S. Network for Democracy in Brazil. Jana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So to kind of set the stage for our conversation about what's happened in Brazil the last couple of years, it would be appropriate to kind of remind listeners about what happened during, well, the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, or Dilma, and the relationship between that impeachment and the Lava Jato, or Operation Car Wash, which was an anti-corruption scandal that used lawfare to prevent PT, the Workers' Party of Brazil, from winning the 2008 election, and also it's what led up to the lawfare that ultimately impeached Dilma. So could you briefly tell us what happened during this time?
Brazil is currently, and it's always been for all of its history, one of the most unequal societies in the world. You have this very white elite, which is, you know, less than 10% of the population. It's a country that had the largest migration of enslaved people from Africa. Over 4 million people were brought to Brazil during the time of slavery. It's, you know, sort of these very ingrained economic, social, and racial inequalities very much mark sort of the country's political history and economic history. And so in that sense, the elites, every time that you've had sort of these populist or left-wing politicians that come to power and start challenging their hegemony, they use usually corruption scandals as a way to kind of change the terms of the political debate and remove these left-wing politicians from power. This happened with Getúlio Vargas back in the 1950s. This happened when the coup, the original military coup in 1964 against the President Jango. And this happened again into 2014 and 2016 with Dilma Rousseff from the Workers' Party. This Lava Jato scandal was linked to these cases of corruption in the state oil company, Petrobras, which is the most important national company in Brazil. Again, there was actual corruption detected among sort of mid-level to higher level executives of the company. Again, some were appointed by the PT, some were not, but there was this sort of incredible, this judge called Sergio Moro, who basically totally abused his powers and tried to extrapolate this corruption that did happen within the oil company, kickbacks and so on, and tried to extend that to make it seem that Lula, former President Lula, and that at the time President Dilma were directly involved in those corruption scandals. And Dilma, ironically, was the president who most did, you know, passed the most laws to empower the judiciary to conduct independent investigations. Sergio Moro goes to the point of actually wiretapping the telephone of ex-President Lula when he was talking to Dilma, then handing over that material of the tapped phone calls to major news networks, like the equivalent of like having illegal wiretapped information being broadcast on ABC or CBS News. And this is like a year and a half after Dilma is reelected. The right-wing parties start questioning the reelection, saying there was electoral fraud. Of course, there was not. And so it becomes this whole sort of scandal, absolutely fabricated by this judge, Sergio Moro, who runs the Lava Jato, and then together with the mass media, all obviously in conjunction with these political and economic elites that, you know, they were absolutely just trying to find any way of getting the PT out of power, because this is a workers' party that was elected and reelected four times. So when they realized that they couldn't win in the ballot box, they used what we call lawfare to, you know, take another route to get Dilma out of office.
Okay. And so the targeting of PT members kind of created this vacuum, right? I mean, Lula was in jail, right? And so that led to the rise of Bolsonaro, Jair Bolsonaro. I think the question on lots of people's minds is that there's often the comparison made between Trump and Bolsonaro. And I'm wondering if you could explain kind of what are the similarities and what are the differences?
Yeah, so basically what happened in Brazil is that you have the sort of traditional right wing, you know, a neoliberal right wing, wouldn't say far right, is the ones that sort of orchestrated this whole impeachment process with the collusion, you know, of Sergio Moro and these, you know, legal operators back in from the period of 2014 on. But part of the process of getting popular support for the impeachment, what we call the coup, the constitutional coup against Dilma, was through organizing massive street protests, you know, obviously manipulating, saying it's against corruption, you know, even though all these corruption cases were totally unfounded. They created or gave political space to these far right groups that started mobilizing and organizing these street protests from about 2015 on. And so basically what happened, Dilma gets impeached August 2016. Then you have Lava Jato car wash investigations continue. Then the sort of accusations start focusing on Lula himself. There was 24 accusations against Lula in several different federal courts and regional courts. And so he goes to prison because he gets judged guilty on one of those cases back in April 2018. And so this is, again, this is the presidential election in Brazil was going to be October 2018. From 2016 to 2018, you had this interim government of right-wing Michel Temer, who was in power, also kind of implementing all the neoliberal reforms that the elites wanted that the PT refused to do. Out of nowhere, once Lula goes to prison, you start seeing as sort of this figure, always very marginalized before, Jair Bolsonaro, kind of with this discourse that he's, you know, he's anti-systemic, you know, he's a populist, he represents, you know, real working class people who are like outside of the corridors of Brasilia, which is the capital, even though he had been elected. I don't know, he'd been in Congress since, I think, I want to say 1992, elected as a member of Congress. So he was certainly absolutely within the political system. But again, someone who was always very marginalized starts gaining more and more attention. In fact, a sort of anecdote, the House of Representatives in Brazil had to one by one vote for or against the impeachment of Dilma in this whole crazy ceremony. And Bolsonaro, when he came up to give his little 1 minute speech about why he was voting for the impeachment, he dedicated his vote to the Colonel Brilhante Ustra, who was the worst torturer of, you know, responsible for over 45 deaths and disappearances during the Brazilian military dictatorship. So then he started getting like all this attention, you know, and he starts leading these street protests. He declares himself a presidential candidate, again, early 2018, but the sort of regular right-wing elites, they're kind of like, oh, you know, this guy's crazy. No one's going to really vote for him in the end. But he used fake news. He used, you know, all these networks that he built up, you know, as well as the support of the evangelical church to basically get elected over the right-wing candidate, you know, and obviously over the PT candidate who, you know, was someone who kind of stepped in at the last minute after Lula was not allowed to run. He came in as this outsider, very similar to Trump, even though he was not an outsider. And again, the discourse being very similar, sort of like, we defend the real Brazilian, again, you know, the hardworking, you know, middle class, white
man. The real
man,
Brazil.
You know.
Yeah. The real parts of Brazil, yeah.
Exactly. So that's similar to kind of the Trump discourse, right? You know, they definitely had a different discourse, even though kind of what brought them to power might have been the circumstances were a little bit different.
So Lula was exonerated. And so he plans to run, right? What would a Lula presidency represent? Not just for Brazilians, but also for Latin America, briefly, if you can.
Yeah, well, that's a big question. You know, first of all, I would say he's got to get elected first. Like, I lived in Brazil the whole period up, you know, in the run up to the 2018 elections. And it was really a horror show. You know, nobody expected that this guy Bolsonaro was going to win. So I think I wouldn't discount something like that happening again, you know, first of all, although there was a poll that was released today, he's leading by 14 points. That's pretty substantial against an incumbent. You know, again, there is a lot of, you know, We're talking about over 800,000 people died of coronavirus in Brazil. You know, Bolsonaro is one of the sort of the most infamous coronavirus deniers, actively, you know, worked to make sure Brazilians didn't get the vaccine, you know. Anyway, so I think what could happen with Lula government, he's going to have a lot of rebuilding to do. You know, Bolsonaro has destroyed a lot of, you know, he's destroyed education, especially higher education. He's destroyed the healthcare, public healthcare system. He's destroyed the environment. You know, you've had massive burning of the Amazon like never before. He's liberating mining, open pit mining in indigenous areas in the Amazon. Problem is that in Brazil, you know, you have 33 political parties who are represented in Congress. He's going to have a very broad coalition to be able to govern. And the question is, who's going to be included in that coalition? So I think it's going to be just as important who gets elected in the Congress as if Lula can actually get elected as president as well, to be able to make real change and to at least reverse the damage that happened under Bolsonaro. A lot can still happen in the next 6 months before the Brazilian elections in October, before we can see, you know, what a PT victory could mean for sort of, you know, a second pink tide, so to speak.
I know. I mean, would you say it would be fair to say that potentially it could be very beneficial for countries that have been under illegal U.S. sanctions, right, to have somebody like a Lula in charge of the largest economy in Latin America to finally be able to break free from the imperialist boot that they've been under as a result of illegal sanctions?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's worth saying that the PT governments, they absolutely had, you know, Cuba, Venezuela as important, you know, both foreign policy and trading partners. One of the most successful social programs that Dilma implemented in her first government was called Médicos Sin Fronteras, where it was Cuban doctors who came to rural areas of Brazil. It was a beautiful thing, you know, and Bolsonaro kicked them all out. So you have massive areas, rural areas in the country that have no medical attention, you know, because Brazilian doctors don't want to go work there, you know, so that's why they had, you know, brought in the Cubans. So yeah, I think it would be a very positive thing for Lula to get elected. You know, it would definitely consolidate a sort of, or return to a more multipolar, you know, sort of geopolitical, you know, situation in the America. You know, UNASUR, that's going to be all revisited under a Lula presidency probably. And that's obviously a very positive thing for these countries that have been, you know, illegally and unfairly targeted by US, you know, sanctions.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jana, for joining us and explaining all this, so wrapping up history in a couple of minutes. It's very much deeply appreciated.
I did my best.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. A big thank you to our KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over these last 2+ years. It does take a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m. And thanks to our contributors and guests this morning for making today's show possible, Bill Resnick and Alice Slater, Louisa Martinez and Jana Silverman, and Jan Hawken and Kedra Playbaugh. Thanks to Patricia Kohlberg for her PR magic. And you can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download The Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. Just a reminder, on February 13th, KBOO Portland Community Radio did kick off our All Thrills, No Frills special programming drive, and everything you hear on KBOO in its own way is special programming because we are a volunteer-powered, member-driven community radio station, and we need your support to keep it going. Information on that special programming can be found on KBOO's website homepage, kboo.fm. Through March 19th, listeners, family, friends, and neighbors will have the opportunity to support KBOO Radio, an important part of our community and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment. These are trying times indeed, and this morning I want to encourage listeners to support KBOO Radio and programs like The Old Mole. We are volunteer-powered, non-commercial, independent, member-supported community radio, and we need your support to keep KBOO on the air for another 50 years. So supporting KBOO is easy. It's just a click away. Donate today at kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44-321 or mail your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast Avenue in Portland. I'm Denise Morris, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.